If you're one of those people who find summer wardrobes tricky, the key is finding items you can wear on repeat, comfortable colors on trend and right for every occasion. That's why I love Quince. They make elevated essentials using premium materials like European linen, organic cotton, and washable silk without the traditional retail markup. Quince's 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops are the pieces you'll reach for all summer long. They're lightweight, effortless to style, and start at just $32. I got the European linen black drawstring shorts, and I adore them. They're polished while being casual and go with everything. Their denim is soft and comfortable. Their organic cotton sweaters are perfect for layering when evenings cool down. Quince's beautiful 14-karat gold jewelry adds a subtle finishing touch. Simple hoops or delicate chains make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. I have the gold U hoops and wear them literally every day. If you watch our clips, you will see me in them. Everything at Quince is priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. Make your summer wardrobe feel easier. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi everyone, welcome to another author interview on the podcast. Now normally I do a long rundown of introducing the person. This one just says today's guest lives in Toronto with her husband and two children. I know she is also the podcast host of Day Drinking with Authors, which is an awful lot of fun. It's my pleasure to welcome Molly Fader. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I feel like the shorter the bio, the more accomplished an author is. I always pad my bio. It's like she feeds squirrels and loves raccoons and everything else. Is there anything else you would like to tell us that is not in the bio that's important?
You know, it's funny. I always feel like the shorter the bio, the more there is, like, I'm hiding. she did time for murder. I had a bio for a while that said, loves playing tennis with her husband. And my husband was always like, we've played tennis like twice. What are you doing? I'm like, I know, but I loved it.
My latest one says that I like playing escape room games in Toronto. So this is part of my murder mystery. But what it doesn't say is I'm the weakest member of the team and that I've got really good escape room teammates, whereas I'm just the person that's like, communicate. You need to communicate. That's all I end up doing. I don't solve anything. I'm just telling people constantly to communicate.
You're just the editor.
Yeah. I'm like the facilitator, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So for those of you who are not watching on YouTube, I am holding up the cover of the book that we're discussing today, Lady X. It's a beautiful cover. It's going to jump off a shelf. And then I'm just going to read you the flap copy so you know what we're talking about. And then Molly and I are going to dive in. So, Los Angeles 2024. Margot Cooper's life explodes after she discovers that her A-list actor husband sent explicit photos to multiple girls on social media. Desperate to get away from the world and the paparazzi, Margot flees to her childhood home with her teenage daughter in tow. But home isn't the sanctuary Margot was hoping for. In a cardboard box in the corner of the attic, she and her sister find damning evidence about a mysterious vigilante named Lady X, including a blurry newspaper photo from the 1970s of a woman who looks an awful lot like their mother. It turns out that Margot's husband isn't the only family member harboring secrets. New York City, 1977. Ginger Daughtry is living her best life with her two beloved roommates until one of them is assaulted. Astounded by the lack of response from the police, the young women take things into their own hands and find themselves igniting a movement that suddenly takes New York City by storm. Soon what begins as a little bit of revenge against terrible men, vandalism here and there, signed collectively as Lady X, starts to take on a life of its own. Their enigmatic reputation spirals beyond their control with copycat criminals running amok under the guise of the enigmatic Lady X. When a body is found fallen or pushed from five stories high, the hunt reaches a boiling point. But Lady X has vanished into thin air. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so Molly, before we dive into that, can you just tell us a bit about your publishing journey? Because you've been doing this for a while. Have there been agent changes, editor changes? Take us through anything that our listeners might find useful.
Well, yes, I wrote previous to writing under the name Molly Fader, I wrote romance for a million years under the name Molly O'Keefe. So I've been in this business for quite some time. The kind of crazy story about Lady X is, for someone who's been in this business for so long, I had written a proposal for this book and I had sent it to the agent that I have had my entire career. And I continue to love this agent dearly. She really, really took great care of me. And she came back and she was like, Molly, I don't love this. And I think you need someone who loves it to sell it. And she was like, take a week and we'll talk about it. And I was like, oh my, do I believe in this idea strong enough? You know, so, you know, do I believe in it so much that I'm willing to, you know, part ways with this agent who's been so, so very good to me? And I decided that I did, that I really believed in this idea. I was really excited about it. And so we got on the phone and I immediately started crying. And I said, I think we
have as you do.
She started crying. And at the end of it, I said, I love you. It's just like this really like heartbreaking breakup. So then I took some time and I really polished up the proposal as everybody, you know, the thing that I really, really worked on was that one sentence log line, you know, so that I could put it in my query letter. And I sent out a batch of proposals, thinking, of course, with 25 years and 50 books behind my, you know, name that this wouldn't be a problem. It was a bit of a problem, you know, a couple of nibbles, but nothing, you know, nothing completely promising. And then I went back and I reworked that log line to make sure that I got Vigilante Girl Gang 1977 in the log line. And then I was very lucky. I sent out the next batch and I had, you know, 5 phone calls and 5 offers for representation. And, you know, my dream agency came back to me and my dream agent said, you know, my roster is full, but we've just hired this young, hungry agent. Do you want to talk to her? And her name's Sophie Cudd from the book group. And so I had a conversation with her and I was like, you know, young and hungry. Let's see how that goes. So yeah, so that's how I got a new agent for this. And then in the small world of publishing, we sent it to one of my very first editors as a romance writer, Shauna Summers at Ballantine at Bantam. And she's who I'm working with now. So it is an incredible full circle moment with Lady X.
There is so much to unpack there. Firstly, the crying with your agent on the phone, because it does feel like a breakup. Because if you find the right agent, it is such an intense relationship, right? You are constantly making yourself vulnerable with this person more than you probably are with best friends in your career. And so it is a big deal when that happens. You go, okay, I've done so many books, it's not going to be a problem to find an agent, and it's still difficult. But I really want to say for our listeners out there, do not go, well, Molly just put together a proposal and she got an agent, so I'm going to do that. You can only do that when you have the chops and when you've got that writing experience, right? I mean, imagine you doing that as a debut, Molly.
No, you know, and it's so interesting. When I sent out the chapters and got a new agent, she was like, you need to write the whole book. Like, before we go to editors, we're going to put together the whole book. And I completely agreed. And the difference, the reality is that those first 3 chapters change so dramatically just by getting to the end of the book. You know, the vision that you had, the way that you were so sure it was going to work out in your head, completely different. And it went through a series of changes. I was, my first agent wasn't a very hands-on editorial agent. And Sophie's been like incredible and crucial and has incredible ideas. So it really changes. So yeah, I the idea that anyone would want to send out a proposal and get a deal at this point just doesn't, like, you got to finish that book. I really do. You need to edit it. You need to get through a couple of edits before. Yeah. That's my take.
Sometimes more than a couple.
Yeah. So always more than a couple.
Yeah.
Never actually just once.
Just a couple. So And again, what you've said about the younger junior agent is so important, because I think so many people are like, this is my dream agent. I want this top agent, right? And they are so busy. They've got their existing clients. For them to take on new clients means they don't have much time to spend with a new client. And when you have a junior agent who's hungry to prove themselves and is being mentored by a really great senior agent, that's the difference. You don't just want a junior agent who is floundering and no one's taking care of them. You want someone who's really being mentored by someone incredible and someone who is super hungry to work with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that is really, really important, and because you're never the person, I feel really important, I feel, is that you're never the person in the room championing your book. You know, so you need all of the people who are going to champion your book to be as passionate about what you're doing as you. And so that's your agent, that is your editor, because your editor really has to fight in a room. Holy moly. So yeah, you just, a young, hungry agent, it's a lot of fun.
And coming back to that log line, you know, because when you said the vigilante girl gang, framing it that way, because I mean, if you go, there's a group of three women in New York who decide to take things into their own hands, blah, blah, blah. Whereas you call them a vigilante girl gang, boom, you've got the hook. And nothing has actually changed except the way you're describing them.
Right. Exactly. The word choice in that log line, you know, and I can't speak for you. I can only speak for myself, but I've been in 1,000 classes, a lot of workshops where it's like, we're going to work on this log line. And you work on it and you work on it and you think you get somewhere close and you know, it feels right, but it doesn't, it lacks that like lightning in a bottle feel. And I feel like every time I get to that place, it's because I'm missing the right word. So you've got to go back and you've got to comb through it one more time and just see how much more dramatic you can make the language. And then you write a book about a vigilante girl gang. And then the next book, you're like, I don't even know, another vigilante girl gang.
But you know, writers these days are so savvy. So I was lucky enough a few weeks ago to meet up with a writing group who had formed from some of our deep dive retreats and, you know, chatting to each other on social media. And so they were like, Bianca, please come join us. They flew in from the US to Canada and got together and were like, just come join us for the day. And I did. And they begin with the log line. Like they all started off before they even started writing. They had this kick-ass log line. They were like, here's my log line. And then they went into their pages. When it came turn for me to read, I was like, no, I don't need to read. And they were like, no, we want to hear what you're working on. And they were like, what's the log line? And I was like, I don't know. I was like, my agent will hopefully figure that out. I was just like, it's kind of about this and it's kind of about that. And I was just so impressed that they were smarter about it, because I think it helps shape the whole story if you've got that up front.
I am a true believer in that. I really am. And
I just got back from Austria and Germany on our family vacation, and we had such an incredible time. The mountains, the people, the food, it was unforgettable. I'm basically one giant pretzel now. Traveling always reminds me just how much humans are alike, and yet our language and culture keeps us unique. And in order to bridge that gap, speaking another language is the thing that can bring us all closer together. Connecting with strangers, ordering your own food, and immersing yourself fully in your vacation location is the best way to travel. That's why I'm thrilled to let you know that Rosetta Stone just came out with Rosetta Stone Sapphire, their biggest launch in over a decade. This brand new language learning app uses the research-backed method Rosetta Stone is known for and adds fresh cutting-edge features, making it easier than ever before to go from knowing a couple phrases to speaking confidently about topics you care about. What I love about Rosetta Stone is that you're not just sitting there memorizing vocabulary. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, which helps you pick it up naturally. You're learning the language the same way you did as a kid. The process is fun, intuitive, and totally immersive. One of the coolest new features is Chat Missions, which turns conversation practice into a game. With Chat Missions, you're put in interactive scenarios like ordering at a restaurant or haggling at a market. Then you're given three objectives, a mission to accomplish, like asking how much something costs, ordering a cold brew coffee, or getting a Wi-Fi password. Along the way, you get real-time corrections and feedback to help you sound more natural and confident. It's a supportive way to build your confidence before putting your language skills to use in real life. I could have used this when I was at the top of a mountain in Austria trying to order lunch for four adults and four kids. Anything to make my travel experience more seamless for our family and friends so we can enjoy our trips to the fullest. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Shit About Writing listeners can get 20% off the Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/today to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/today.
Hi, everyone. It's time to register for the next beta reader matchup, with the matchup emails going out on the 8th of September. As per usual, you'll be submitting 3,000 words from your work in progress, and I'll be matching you up with writers in similar time zones and or genres. Many of the beta reader groups turn into writing groups with a lot of longevity, which is always marvelous to see. To sign up, go to my website, biancamurray.ca, and go to the beta reader matchup page. I look forward to matching you.
I don't know so much that you have to have it at the beginning of your book. I do think that helps, like as a blueprint kind of thing, but you've got to have it at some point. Like if you don't really know what your book is totally about until the end, that's fair. We've all been in that position, but I'm a firm believer in it. That sales brain that I've never been very good at, because again, it helps you find champions. You know, it gives them the words to go into the rooms and do the fighting.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so let's begin with the prologue. I'm going to read it for everybody. Love a good prologue that works. Because remember, on the podcast, you're always like, no, we don't like this prologue. But that's because we say, do not use a shitty prologue as a band-aid for opening chapters that are not doing the heavy lifting. So here we go. New York City is supernaturally dark. No streetlights or traffic lights. The darkened buildings are looming black shadows in the indigo sky. The Milky Way is visible under southern Manhattan, and it's not natural. The night is loud with sirens and shouting. Something somewhere is burning. Across the street, people have gathered in the shadowy dark park with beers and a guitar because it's cooler outside and the rules don't apply during a citywide blackout. They don't seem to see the body on the sidewalk. They didn't hear it fall. The crescent moon is reflected in the growing puddle of blood around it. I'm sorry, she thinks, but she's not. Lady X is dead. She must be. Dun, dun, dun. Right, so let's again discuss intentionality. Did you begin with the prologue? Was it something that was added? Like, what is the purpose that it fulfills, that it had to be there and couldn't be taken out?
So I agree 100% on the rules about the prologue. That said, I'm also very much a sucker for a prologue. So, and you're right. If it's trying to fix some really crummy first chapters, it's a, you know, you've just created a mess. I knew going in that I was going to have to create these interstitials that created the lore around Lady X and sort of gave the reader a taste of who this made up person is. You know, became like the, you know, when you're creating somebody who's kind of important culturally and socially. So I knew that I was going to have these interstitials. So initially it was like a, you know, a newspaper article, but that was so dry. So anyway, it just grew into this, and the stakes created. You knew going in that someone was dead. That's never a bad thing.
Sets the tone as well, which is awesome. Okay, so to discuss the structure of the novel, we've got, and I've got to be careful how I pronounce this because everybody laughs at me because it's dual as opposed to jewel.
How do you usually say it?
I say jewel, and then somebody emailed me and was like, what is a J-E-W-E-L timeline? So I'm like, okay, dual timeline and dual POV interspersed with like op-eds, newspaper articles, etc. So did you know up front that was kind of the structure you were going for? Was it something that, you know, came through in the edits? Let's speak a bit about that as well.
Yes, I knew it was going to be a dual timeline. Initially, it was not just the two POVs, the one woman in the past and one woman in the present. Initially in the past, like I had a POV for everybody. I'm definitely a writer who has to pare down. I kind of start with every noodle I have at my disposal at the moment.
Ambitious.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like you want every book to be ambitious, right? Like you're really trying to do something with every book. So you've got to see what, what worked. So we pared that down. And then the interstitials, I wanted every interstitial to both comment upon what the reader had just read and foreshadow something else without giving anything away. And some of them were just fun. Some of them I just threw in because I liked them. So, you know, every interstitial, the first rule of business was it has to create this larger than life character. It has to help create the larger than life character, and it has to keep the stakes high. And then it has to capture and encapsulate what they just read and make the pages turn to what's next. So it was ambitious. I messed it up so many times. I still don't, like, when I'm reading it, I kind of skip over those because all they are is like troubling memories to me. So yeah, that was the hardest part.
Yeah, getting that structure right is so difficult. And I'm working on something at the moment that also, for the first time, is going to require interstitials. And I've just decided I'm going to just write the story and then I'm going to come back and put in those interstitials because I'm not quite sure yet where the best place is for them. Because like you say, it needs to do something more. It needs to move the story forward in terms of foreshadowing or whatever. So something that authors sometimes just need to play around with. And when you do a dual timeline, dual POV, there's always the risk that one timeline is going to be more compelling than the other. So it's so difficult to make sure that the readers aren't like, oh my God, we're now in this timeline, but actually I want to be in this time. So again, how do you ensure that's not the case? Do you have sort of action beats for each storyline that you feel like you need to hit? How do you make each one as compelling?
You know, it's really interesting. And I'm a dual timeline fan, a reader fan. And so I was very cognizant of those books that I've read that I was like, oh, that timeline is a bummer. And there are reviews that people are like, man, they do not like Margot. So, you know, you even when you feel like you nail it, other reader, you know, readers
can't please everyone all the time.
Yeah. I knew that the present day timeline could not just be about the women finding out what happened in the past. And I feel like that is a very common mistake that writers do in dual timeline. So it's not enough to support that present day timeline is finding out the secrets. So I knew that I needed to have the women in the present day timeline really going through their own things. So having Margot's situation with her husband and kind of like coming into her own rage, that was the driving force with that. And also having her daughter Skye's, all the stuff that had happened with her at school. So with those two things being the real, and also Skye and Julia's forming friendship and their kind of quest to like find out who Lady X is. So I knew that I was working with those three things to keep the present day timeline afloat.
Yeah, because the past timeline is super compelling in its own right. And I thought it was so genius to have the movie star husband in the present timeline being accused of sexual harassment, etc., because she could have gone home for any reason. You could have just had her there and her sister calls because the mom is not well, etc. So it could have just been mom's not well, I need you to come back, and they work through the boxes. But like you say, the stakes were raised so hugely by what this movie star husband does. And what I loved as well is that he was once very famous. Then he wasn't famous for the longest time because he wasn't getting parts and he was at home and whatever. And then suddenly his star rose again, which made it even more interesting. So again, was that something that you knew upfront had to be the case? Why have it that he's not just, his star's rising now? Why have it that he's, you know, he was famous then, wasn't then, is again? Because I love looking at the intentionality of everything that a writer chooses to do.
Well, that's a really great question. I wanted Margot to wrestle with not just having a husband. You know, Margot has every privilege. She is rich. She is white. She, you know, has wealth and means. And men, the man in her life still knocks her feet out from under her. So I wanted to show that, you know, women aren't necessarily safe in lots of different kinds of situations. So I also wanted, as a woman who's 50,
like wrestling with, this is not just a betrayal of me. This is a betrayal of everything we have built. This is my family. You know, I'm a 50-year-old woman. I have two kids. I have a husband. And that's a lot of my identity. Like, I don't know a 50-year-old woman in the same boat who isn't. So when something like this happens, you know, you can't just walk away. No matter how betrayed and gross and awful this person you married is, like, you need a minute to go, how do I reframe who I am without this person? So that was an interesting dilemma to me, and sort of showing an older, you know, a middle-aged woman versus the young women in the 70s was sort of interesting, who were dealing with some very big stuff, but who were like, let's burn it down. Like, two women of those three were like, immediately burn it all down. And I just was really interested in Margot, who was like, how do I burn it down? Can I burn it down? What does it mean if I burn it down? Yeah. And that she ends up burning it down. It's just satisfying to me. But
I can't understand that people had a problem with her POV. It just shows you how subjective this all is.
Yeah.
Because she had an excellent character arc. If she started off a certain way and ended up a certain way, then okay, fine, she's frustrating. You know, you kind of want to shake her. But like, you read to see how a character overcomes adversity and how they evolve and, you know, how they grow in the process. And what, some readers just didn't like that?
Indeed. I mean, it's not a lot, but there are some who, yeah, they wanted Margot to be tougher right off the bat. And, you know, that's just not, I don't even think I would deal, you know, putting yourself in those shoes. Like, it's just so traumatic. So anyway, it's always interesting to see what readers are going to think about.
Yeah.
I think it's also maybe younger readers too feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, talking about generational differences. So you have an ensemble cast in each timeline, you know, great secondary characters that are super compelling, that affect the plot in so many ways. It's not just they're kind of there as puppets. They also have agency. They also affect the plot. And I love how we had the different generational perspectives. So even though Skye is not like a POV character, so for our listeners, Skye is Margot's daughter. Just like seeing her take on things compared to her mom's take on things was really great. There was a lot of social commentary there as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know how your brain works as you're building a book, but I often walk around with like two or three kind of ideas or things that I'm thinking about. And obviously with this book, you know, we had just watched this election in the United States, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And so like a lot of women, I was just walking around very angry, you know, the Epstein file, all of it, like a lot of women. And then at the same time, my daughter was in middle school, and like every girl in middle school since the dawn of time, since the dawn of middle school, was getting harassed by this boy. A group of her friends were getting harassed by this boy. And I, you know, go to the teacher. I went to the teacher, you know, all these things that I found coming out of my mouth that were the same things that my mother said to me, right? Ignore him and it'll go away, right? Like, to my great shame, I said this to my daughter, and my daughter and her friends were like, no. And they went to the principal, and the kid got in a lot of trouble and was expelled for a little bit, got some help. Like, they did the right thing. And I just thought, oh my, if anything's really going to change, what I did there has to change. Like, that was a part of the problem as much as like letting these boys grow into men who get away with this stuff is what mothers with daughters in middle schools have been helping make happen. So that was a real eye-opening experience for me. And I was so proud of my daughter and proud of her friends for not putting up with it. So I had those two things kind of swimming around in my head that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. And it's amazing how what's going on in their personal lives for each of them is mirroring this greater political movement in the background, you know, for the 70s timeline and for the present day timeline. I actually Googled, was Lady X real? You know, because you built her so brilliantly. You built the infamy so brilliantly that I was like, oh, this has to be real. So was that inspired by somebody at the time, or you just made that shit up?
I made that shit up. I mean, it was having those two ideas, my anger and the situation with my daughter and how I was, you know, a part of a long line of enablers. And then the Taylor Swift song Vigilante shit came into the world. And so that was the sort of lightning strike that put all of this together. But I knew, I mean, I do think the thing that the Lady X, I've heard that before, that I Googled it, it's the hard work on those interstitials. I really, like, as a person, as you're going into it, just work as hard as you can at nailing it, because it really does create that world, that lore. So yeah, I just made her up, but
such an excellent job. When people are Googling, is this real? You know, you've absolutely nailed it. Well, Molly, we're at our time somehow. So I'm holding up the book again, Lady X. You can get it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. And if you get it there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Pick up this book. There's so much happening. It's incredible. It'll give you all the feels. And yeah, it helped give me somewhere to vent for my own rage, which was awesome. Because the thing with fiction is you can see justice prevailing. And in real life, generally that doesn't happen. And that's what's so satisfying about a book like this.
Yeah. And as we're all, like, we all need some hope, right? We really need some hope that these dark days will change. And I really hope Lady X helps with that.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.